now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game. I'm Gabriel Marcotti with a football podcast from The Times, where Premier League fans can get every goal, every game, everywhere. Now, first off, a quick reminder that you can join the football debate at our live show in Newcastle on November 20th. You might even be able to meet George Culkin in the flesh and have your photograph taken with him. Tickets will cost £5 for Times Plus members and £7.50 for non-members. To book, please visit www.cetickets.com/the Times, or better yet, just call 0871-620-4025. But be quick about it, because tickets are going fast. Anyway, back to the present, and a big welcome to my guests, Tony Cascarino, Jim Proudfoot, and from beautiful downtown Barnes, it's Alison Rudd. Alison, let's start with you, since you're filling in for Tony Evans, who can't make it today, and he's a football editor, he's our boss. He would have gone first, so it's your turn. United and Arsenal, 1-0 win for Davy Moyes' men. Is this a turning point?
I don't think it's a turning point for Arsenal particularly. I think there's a convergence of a lot of things going wrong for them, and if they've got any sense at all, they'll go away and think, well, we just got the really bad game out of our system. For United, I think it was a turning point. They've been lucky in a way. The crowd have supported them when they've looked a little bit fragile and a little bit lost, and they really responded when they looked a bit grittier. I think people speak about how Arsenal are over-reliant on only having one fit striker in Giroud. United are over-reliant on Van Persie and Rooney firing. But under Moyes, when you've looked at United, there's been at least two or three players where you thought, what are they doing in the United side? And that squad isn't strong enough. And it's been really easy to have a right go at several players. But every single player, they were okay. They were good. They were good. They worked hard. There might not have been a lot of flair going on there, but they worked incredibly hard. And I think they really sucked up the fact they could tell that Arsenal were, as Wenger said, nervous, and they went for the jugular. It was quite interesting. They went for the jugular almost just the once, and then once they got the lead, they just made sure that they defended well and stoically, and it was a deserved 1-0 victory.
Cass, on this issue of, you know, you look at players and you say, what are they doing in the United side? Once Vidic went off, if you really wanted to be negative, you know, you could look at Smalling and Jones and Evans and I guess Fellaini came on at the end and Cleverley and Valencia. And you could get kind of down and conclude that, well, Van Persie and Rooney are the difference makers and the other guys are just kind of there to kind of make sure that they don't concede.
Yeah.
Would that be harsh?
I think slightly harsh, because I did think the victory was based on what really Alisson touched on, is sweat, blood, and, you know, just passion, desire, a hunger that was there for everybody to see.
This is Manchester United, though. Should it not be based on having good players?
Yeah, well, they do. They do have good players.
But they don't. They have those guys I mentioned. I don't mean to say they don't, but let me put it a different way. If you go back a few years, and it was Vidic in his pomp, you know, not older Vidic who gets hurt, Ferdinand in his pomp, Gary Neville in his pomp, Scholes and young Giggs and Beckham. You look at this now, it's undeniably different, I think.
I'd agree with you. I think that you've got a valid point that, you know, this is a United team that, if we judge on the season so far, have been indifferent, Gab, even in the Champions League. The victory against Bayer Leverkusen, Real Sociedad, and, you know, real average performances. This was probably the best of the season so far, wasn't it, for them? Especially first half, the way they sort of manoeuvred to out physical Arsenal in every department, which worked. Yeah, they are. I think Smalling's a, you know, as a right back, I think he lacks quality on the ball, but it gives them a sense of, you know, a physical aspect as much as what I thought Moyes selected his team to intimidate and bully Arsenal slightly. I could look at other players in the team and totally agree with you and think, you know, Johnny Evans, is he the class of Rio and Vidic? Absolutely not. I don't think there's a debate there. Is Jones ready to step up to the plate of being a midfielder like Keane? Nowhere near. So they're well short, but they have got two guys that, like we touched on before, up front that can win them games and turn them. And again, they did it at Fulham and they've done it with Van Persie's goal. It's, you know, we always say average United teams. I think there's a lot of guys who are lucky to wear United shirts on a regular basis.
Were you going to name some names for me?
Well, I just did. What did I say? Smalling, Johnny Evans. You know, Valencia in and out. But
Johnny Evans is a squad defender, right?
Well, he's a squad defender.
Who
has to play finding
a lot,
himself
going to
probably play a lot of games this year, Gab. This season, I think he'll play a lot of football.
Jim, were you expecting a more buccaneering United, or did you kind of conclude that, you know, Moyes is comfortable playing this way?
I didn't think that there would be so few chances created, and that when it comes down to it, that basically Arsenal would be beaten with their failure to defend one set piece, and that would be the sum total of the game. I thought that Manchester United probably played to the strengths of the manager, and to a large extent, to the strengths of the team. And there's no point in sending his team out as a buccaneering team if the general consensus of opinion amongst us all is that there are a number of players in the United side who probably, in many other years, wouldn't be playing for Manchester United. So I think he's got to try and put round pegs in round holes. He did that to a large extent.
You don't necessarily need phenomenal players to go and play with a more attacking style. I mean, I agree with you that Moyes needs to play the way he's comfortable, but, you know, you could have found room for people like Nani or Welbeck. You could have played cleverly in midfield instead of Jones, for example. And I mean, there are things that he could have done if he were so inclined.
If he were so inclined, but the bottom line is, Gab, and I know you're only being devil's advocate, he set out a side that he thought could win that game. And Arsenal are a very good footballing team. How do you win a game? It's not just about being more buccaneering than the opposition. It's about stopping the opposition scoring. And that is the way on which David Moyes has based much of his managerial success. And I'm sure it will continue to be the way on which he will build on much of his managerial success, because he is a more conservative manager than his predecessor. And there's no getting away from that.
When we saw that goal from Van Persie, two things came to mind. One was, boy, with Mertesacker, that probably would not have happened. And frankly, that's one of those weird Wenger things where you replace a guy who's 6'6", 6'7", with a guy who is listed as 6', but it's probably smaller than that, in Thomas Vermaelen. But the other thing is, I mean, like, here comes the whole, like, zonal marking, man marking palaver once again. Now, I humbly submit to you, Cass, that the problem here isn't zonal marking. Because man for man, Arsenal are a smaller team than United, and had they gone man for man, it might have been beaten anyway, or probably would have been. It's just that if you're going to mark zonally, they executed it about as badly as they could have.
It was incredible for me to watch, Gab, where I'm watching three or four United players have no one within them 3 yards in an 18-yard penalty area. They can all literally pick, run and jump, get leverage and get a free header. Now, anybody that's headed the ball, and I headed a lot, as all three of you would know, that if you get challenged or you're opposed or you have someone tight to you to make it difficult, it's very hard to get a perfectly timed header and controlled header. Now, Van Persie, when he made the run, he was one of four that could have scored there. He would totally... The ability to not defend against that, I thought, I couldn't believe what I saw. When I watched the goal again, I was thinking, really? If that's something they must have worked on. They must have set up like this in training. And it's so easy to play against.
Did you figure out what Ramsey was doing as well?
Well, I think Ramsey was up against Van Persie, wasn't he?
Yeah, but Ramsey steps towards the ball as it comes and it just goes over his head.
Yeah, well, it's... Gab, you've got to be. I mean, it's something... It's so... I hated being marked and being marked tightly because it was so hard to get that half a yard's difference. So, you know, you felt players could always, even if they did get close to you, you got a free header. 9 times out of 10, you'd be a little bit more off balanced. And watching the goal again, it's ended up costing them dearly because, like Jim and Alison, we've all said, the game was hanging in a balance and basically got one zonal marking goal. I've never seen a team win a major tournament or premiership or a top flight competition doing zonal marking, and yet I've seen teams do it and very good teams do it.
Now, JP, Wayne Rooney was praised to high heaven for his work rate. I almost wondered if they weren't getting a little bit carried away, because they showed him at one point, like, he hits this crossfield ball behind Kagawa, and Kagawa has to, like, kind of run back to get it. And they're like, oh, look at him, you know, feathering the ball across the pitch. There was obviously no issue with his stamina, with his intensity, and he did make a big contribution. That being the case, why is it? Is he just fitter now? Or is a lot of the issues that he was having last year, when people blamed his fitness and whatever else, should they maybe not have been blaming his fitness and maybe blaming something else instead?
I don't know. That's a difficult question, Gab, to be honest. I think he is fitter. Whether he's done more sort of specific, individually tailored conditioning work over the summer, I don't know. But he does look fitter. He certainly had the intensity that perhaps has been lacking in previous games. But you're right, it might be down to other factors. It might have been down to the fact that at some level he was disaffected last season, and that was having a ramification on his performance. I don't know. I really don't know. It would be speculation either way. But the bottom line is that it has to be good for Manchester United that he was able to produce the kind of performance he did yesterday. And yeah, I agree with you that a lot of the praise really was sort of gushing in the extreme, and David Moyes was praising him to high heaven as well. I think it was an outstanding performance by Wayne Rooney, but I don't necessarily think that there was the necessity for the hyperbole about it that perhaps was received.
Cass, on Rooney's fitness, I mean, JP, very honest there, says he doesn't know. Do you know? I mean, one of the things that struck me is last year was his fitness issue. People were saying, oh, look, he's fat, he's not a good athlete, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And I always thought, like, no, actually, this guy works his rear end off, often manages to remain lucid and focused while doing so. And, I mean, is there some kind of marked improvement here?
I was in Vegas a few years back. Wayne was there. Wayne lived his life to the full on a regular basis, night in, night out. And he certainly knew how to party off the field. And I think there's times when Wayne does that. And I think, well, the Wayne we saw in the 2006 World Cup, where he was completely unfit. Wayne, unfortunately, and like myself, I needed my backside kicked regular. Train hard as I could, to get the best out of me. And I was never the levels of Wayne Rooney. But unfortunately for Wayne, he gets a big posterior. So if he's not worked his socks off, and I think there's been times where he's not dedicated his life to football as much as he should have, and then you see a different Wayne Rooney. When you see him like he is yesterday, you're absolutely spot on. It wasn't a performance of a magician, technically superb. It was a guy that showed his touch can be good, his work rate changed, you know, a lot of attacks for United and the things that happen in the game. And I think when Wayne's like that, I think he's a hell of a good player. How long will it last? I don't know. I always feel that there's always a turning point. If I was Roy Hodgson, I'd have him man-to-man marked after the end of the season, have a bodyguard with him and mark him wherever he went, not letting him go off the rails, because he did it in the last competition. He went 10 days to Vegas before the last competition. Was it the World Cup? And Wayne came and played the World Cup, and it was like he was a different player, a different person. He has to stay on top of his game, and that means physically. And then I think you've got a much different animal.
All right, enough United and Arsenal, because our producer, who's filling in for Skinner, is telling me to move on. Clearly, he's more interested in talking Sunderland and City rather than the league leaders and the biggest team in Britain. Now, City go to the Stadium of Light, and they lose to a Sunderland team that are supposed to be awful. It's the fourth consecutive year, I believe. Alison, do you believe in weird cosmic karma, or is this just happenstance?
I don't think it's cosmic. I think it's yet another example of how Manchester City go away from home as if they are going into a vacuum. There's this very peculiar attitude they seem to have, that you go somewhere and you don't think about where you're going. I mean, they did not behave like a team that knew it would be full of passion and full of optimism because of the recent results over the last couple of years. And it was a team that desperately needed a win, and it had a new manager, and their home form has suddenly become something that's notable, that they seem to be, Gus Poyet seems to have got it right at home. None of these things appeared to have occurred to City. It's like looking at a painting where the colours are muted. The City are full of players, are full of vibrancy and exquisite skill and flair, and it's like they're doing football by numbers when they go away from home. We're just so good, aren't we? That we just keep passing the ball around, it'll happen. And it's as though they're shocked by any tough tackling or any stoic defending or any passion on the pitch or in the stands. It's peculiar because you think you might make that mistake once, especially under a new manager, but you don't keep making the same mistake. I mean, it's good to have faith. It's good to have faith in your ability and to think, yeah, we are utterly the class team of the Premier League. We shouldn't have to take into account the way the opposition works, especially if they're in the bottom half of the table. But that's what a good manager does. He goes somewhere and he thinks, they're going to dictate things because they're at home. We can't just let them do that. And yet they do.
All right, so I'm going to put on my Manuel Pellegrini hat because I'm sure, because I read his excellent, or watch his excellent Monday inquest in Times Online. So I imagine Cass will have words of praise for Brown and O'Shea. So before we get to that, I want to throw this to you, JP, because I'm going to put on my Pellegrini hat. I'm going to defend Pellegrini here, right? Sebastian Larsson goes in, sives down Javi Garcia in any normal circumstance in the world with any normal referee in any normal country. He's sent off, and then we're talking a different game. Ooh, Phil Bardsley, isn't he great? Look, he's not drunk, and he's not lying around the casino. Okay, yeah, he also fouled James Milner in the build-up to the goal, and that goal should have never stood, and if he tries to shoot like that again, never in a month of Sundays does he score. City boss possession by a billion miles. They create a million more chances, roughly speaking, than the opposition. Pellegrini comes out after the game and says he's not concerned at all. He doesn't need to change anything because they're outplaying the opposition, and sometimes you just happen to lose. I mean, what should he have done differently?
Is he wrong? No, in essence, he's not wrong. If you look at it like that, there were mitigating circumstances behind the defeat. But I've commentated on all four of City's defeats away from home so far this season. I would say that this is the most galling. This is the one where they've played the worst of the four. At Cardiff, they showed that they couldn't defend a set piece, which obviously was inexplicable to some extent, but then you looked at the personnel that was there and perhaps it was a little bit, there was a greater explanation than, maybe first appeared. Then they lose at Villa, where 19 times out of 20, they've outplayed Villa so much, they win that game, and Joe Hart was at fault for two of the goals. At Chelsea, there was that late brainstorm, and in many ways, they were the better side over about an hour of that game. This game, albeit the fact, I totally agree with you, the fact that Mike Dean didn't send off Larsson was completely inexplicable. I cannot remotely understand what he thought he saw. And then to book Javi Garcia for a little petulant flick out 5 minutes later, it was just completely inexplicable. Really bad refereeing. I think that was a worse decision than allowing the goal to stand when Bardsley has come together with Milner, and many referees would have given a free kick to Manchester City for that as well on the edge of the penalty area. So Pellegrini is right to a certain extent, and he can look at various things, but it's happened in four of their six away games. So that would suggest that there is a more deep-rooted and deep-lying problem than just, do you know what, we were unlucky.
You're gonna wax lyrical about all your Irish friends,
no,
right?
No, I'm not going to wax lyrical. One thing that stood out for me, and despite what we're saying, and Jim and Alisson, and, you know, we're all talking about Man City and how brilliant they've been, and Jim's, you know, gave a perfect description of what I've seen for them away from home. But do you know what stands out for me? They're an awful laid-back approach to acceptance of a defeat. It's like, well, we played well, yeah, we played well, and everything's fine, yeah, and if we play like that again, we'll win. Well, unfortunately, they've lost four games on the road, and everyone has a telling story to the way they've been beaten. So I find that strange to hear a manager talk in that manner.
Maybe he's confident that they're going to regress to the mean.
He's going to have to be. So what happens if it happens on the next time on the road? They play better than they do yesterday, and then they don't win the game. And
they say, well,
we had 24 chances. We didn't convert them. My strikers didn't do what they were good. You know, you can't get away with that, Gab. A big football club.
So what's he supposed to do? Like, go freak out and rant and rave and say, like, we're all rubbish, change the team, Jovetic back on.
No, you don't. But I tell you what, there was an often acceptance of a defeat. I didn't like that. I felt there should be far more.
See, it's interesting because you introduce an interesting theme here. I mean, I believe we all have kids, actually. But, you know, something when your kid misbehaves or screws up, I think as a parent, Pellegrini's a parent too, of little Agüeros and Lescott's. Do you react by reading them the riot act, or do you react by saying, look, you did your best, you were actually unlucky on the day, don't change the way you're preparing for your exam or whatever else? Alison?
This is a really good point. The reason he's not chastising them is I don't think they're doing what he hasn't asked them to do. They are going into these matches in a very calm mindset with a great deal of confidence in the system that they play and the talent that they have. I doubt very much anything happened at the Stadium of Light that he felt that they'd let him down because he'd asked them to do one thing and they did something else on an individual level. I don't think particularly that anyone had a poor game or made crass errors. I think what he should have done is come out and said, I have got it wrong.
Jim, I want to throw this to you, though, because one thing that strikes me is it's all fine and good to talk about this. Ultimately, it's the players on the pitch. And at the risk of being harsh here, it's one thing to have Vincent Kompany in his pomp and young Mr. Nasty alongside him. It's quite a different one to have Julian Lescott and Martin De Michelis. There's a reason Lescott's the fifth choice center half or whatever he is at Manchester City. And there's a reason that Martin De Michelis was basically, his career was basically over. And then, you know, he went to Malaga, the mini revival. But, you know, is still an older, I think, rather limited player. Should they have maybe signed another center half or playing Yaya Toure back there or whatever? Because it's pretty absurd when you look at the wealth of options and qualities at one end of the pitch and at the other end when those two guys aren't there.
They should have gone out and bought another center half. And it's not as if there's a hugely limited budget and that every pound that's being spent is being scrutinised through a microscope from those in the corridors of power. That just isn't the case. And they have left themselves short. I've no doubt in January they'll go out and buy somebody, but the problem is they might have lost another three or four games away from home by then. They desperately need another centre-half because the two that played yesterday aren't good enough, probably individually, but certainly in tandem.
Final words on Gus Poyet, because obviously we've been down the road of Sunderland and, you know, Martin O'Neill in his inimitably classy way goes back and has a go at the previous manager and yuck, yuck, yuck. And the funny thing is, I've had the call say, I wish I could have signed 50 players like he did. Actually, he didn't sign them and they all broke, and actually Sunderland broke even in terms of transfers. All you did was go and spend a lot of money, like you've always done throughout most of your career. But anyway, enough of him. Gus, can you keep them up? Anybody want to go on? Give me some percentages and some reasons why, starting with you, Alison?
100%, yes.
Jim, in my mind, you live somewhere south of the M25, so which makes you instantly qualified to talk about everything that happens down there, including Brighton. So I'm assuming you've got a very good perspective. I need your percentage and your analysis of Poyet.
I don't think Poyet was necessarily the man that I would have chosen, but he's done better than I thought he would have done up to this point. I agree with Alison that he will keep them up. I think there's probably now a 70-75% chance they will stay up.
Cass, you get the final word. Percentage chance of Sunderland staying up.
Well, first, I thought Gus Poyet was a lucky man to get the job. I thought that Brighton, that he had a big budget, the best attendances in the Championship, paid big wages, and didn't really achieve as much as a lot of people sort of promoted him in the game for a big job. But with that, I think he's gone back to basics at Sunderland. He's united the group, which is clearly shown in the couple of home performances we've seen. The teams that are worse than them, without doubt, is Palace and Fulham. So now you're coin flipping between the Norwiches, the West Hams. Will Hull drop back in there?
West Ham?
Well, I think West Ham have got a real problem that by Christmas and not having Andy Carroll is a massive problem for them, because the way that Sam wants to play the game. So I think they're going to still struggle to win games, like we saw at Carroll Road at the weekend. I would give them a 50-50 chance. I think they're nowhere near out of the woods yet. I think it'll take a lot of hard work. That he's doing it the right way so far, but there's lots and lots of... I think Fulham is the real big one, because I do think that they're the team that absolutely look like they're going to go down with Palace at the moment. But a change of manager and a change of things like Sunderland did, because it easily happened at Craven Cottage.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In our debate this week, it was interesting because I had successive tweets from Gary Neville and Matt Dickinson on my Twitter timeline, which really intrigued me. Gary Neville talking about how he thought that this was the best Premier League that he's ever seen, including all the ones he played in. And then we had Matt Dickinson basically saying the opposite of that, which I thought was interesting because I'm just sort of imagining the two of them sitting there debating the issue over a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice. But we're not going to talk about that, although that might be one for another time. I was struck by what you said in your inquest, your issue, Tony, with penalty kicks and diving and so on. And obviously, we had Ashley Young in midweek, again, after David Moyes told him not to do it. We can debate whether Ramirez was a dive. I think most people would probably agree that Ramirez, that was not a penalty. Not necessarily a dive, perhaps, but definitely not a penalty. We had this bizarre incident at the end of the Stoke and Swansea game with that handball, which nobody saw except for the referee and Asmir Begovic. I want to chuck this over to you. What's your take on penalties? You suggested to me before, we're getting too obsessed with penalties.
Mm. I think it's controlling the game. I think it's controlling outcomes of games, Gab. Every Monday morning, I'm having conversations with people about slight contact, having pundits go on TV and slow down action that they're seeing on a game to prove that there's the minimum amount of contact for a penalty. I'm finding it... I'm disheartened by that penalties become one of the most important weapons of winning a football match or losing a football match. And sometimes, like the draw for West Brom. And I'm wondering where penalties are going, because where we were 10 years ago, we've gone accelerated to a level that is now becoming, it's actually becoming laughable. I think it's an embarrassment for football. And I wonder whether the penalty even should exist in the next decade, because if we go the next decade like the last decade has gone, we're going to have penalties even worse than we're seeing now. Football has to come to terms. They need to do something about this particular decision that is determining the outcome of too many football matches.
What would your solution be?
Well, the way I felt after this weekend, I want to get rid of it. It's like, what, you know, they changed the laws of kicking people.
Award direct free kicks in the penalty area instead?
I'm sure we could find some solution, Gab, but bottom line is, if we ain't going to be prepared to use technology, like we're ignoring in football, the authorities are totally turning a blind eye, and they've only just about give us, thankfully, goal line technology. That's one great thing. This is an incident that's happening game in, game out, every level, across Britain and across the world in football. On a regular basis, Gab, this is happening. So I have a real bee in my bonnet about where penalties and what they're doing to the game. I think in some ways they're ruining football.
Alison, you're our resident closest thing we have to a qualified ref. Do you see where Cass is coming from? Do you have a solution?
I do see where he's coming from, because I was at the Chelsea game and it wasn't a penalty. And You know, Steve Clark says, well, there's no point me going to talk to the referee because he might apologise. Referees do occasionally apologise to me, but I don't get the points back. All the hard work just goes in a puff of smoke because of one mistake, one poor interpretation of what's happened. And it's definitely worth debating. The trouble is you wouldn't get rid of them because they're there to protect crass defending. So if you were to suddenly say, well, we're not going to have penalties anymore, there'd be an awful lot of hacking down in the penalty area because people, defenders or anybody knew they could they could get away with it. And it's impossible to bring in a system where you only award a penalty if you're sure that it was non-controversial. That's why the referee's there. He has to make an interpretation. I don't know. When you go to referee school, you are told that you can't possibly know everything. All that matters is that you behave as though you're 100% certain about what you've done. And no decision is a bad thing. Make a decision. So you either say play on or you give the free kick, or if it's in the penalty area, that becomes a penalty. So maybe there should be some discussion with referees about how these incidents that are close calls, if you're not absolutely certain what you've seen and you're not getting any feedback from your assistants that they're absolutely certain, then let's stop giving these what seem to be 50-50 decisions.
You know, this is weird because Guillaume Balague and I make a list of things that we only hear in this country and nowhere else. And one of those is the referee has to be 100% sure to give it. It's just weird. I hear it repeated all the time. And surely, Alison, that's not what they taught you in referee school. Because
that's not what I said.
You're saying in the future would be good.
They know you're not going to be 100% sure. What you're taught, well, it's a while ago now that I did it. I mean, maybe it's changed. But what they tell you is the worst thing you can do as a referee is give the impression that you're not sure, that you don't know.
Right, I agree with you.
You will lose credibility. Okay, you will lose discipline. It will all go to pot if you act like, oh, I'm not sure what to do. So you pretend, I'm not entirely sure what happened, but I'm going to pretend I'm absolutely certain that that was a free kick. And that's the only way you can keep control of a match.
All right, guys, so we've got referees pretending they're sure when they're not. Wouldn't it be easy if we just accept the fact that our referee, and there's better referees and worse referees, makes his best educated guess about what happened?
Gab, I've had referees who are refereeing today say to me they made that decision on a gut reaction as well. So they've got a gut reaction. They actually don't know. They're coin flipping whether they know.
I think you'll find Mark Halsey is no longer refereeing.
Well, there are referees out there.
There are other ones.
But Gab, if we choose to ignore technology, which is our assistance.
Okay, but we're not having a debate about technology.
But
you know what?
Point.
Sorry, on the point of technology, you will recall, and I'm remembering Jim on this too, because this whole issue with people like, oh, look, retroactive action, ban them for 10 games, right? Which you hear all the time. So there have been situations where people have tried to introduce retrospective punishment for players who dive. And what they found is that there are certain obvious situations where players cheat, like players who score. Like Girardino got done in Italy. He scored with his hand once and went off to celebrate. And it was obvious he'd scored, with his hand, Paul Scholes style. I would extend it out to situations where the player gets struck in the chest and he goes down clutching his face. You're obviously cheating. I throw the book at you. However, when it comes to actual diving and accentuating falls, whether it's Ashley Young or you go back to the case with Eduardo when Arsenal played Celtic, I think it was some 6 or 7 years ago, what you find is that it's actually extremely difficult to be 100% certain that somebody was intentionally conning the referee. Because we need to be clear on this, that if I foul you while we're playing football, it doesn't matter if it was intentional or not. If it's a foul, it's a foul. But with simulation, it has to be intentional. There's no accidental diving.
Yeah, but Gab, I'm not arguing the fact. I'm not caring about retrospective
evidence. But you're talking about video technology.
No, I'm talking about instant, available, why the game is happening, a decision, that's a penalty or not.
Right. And what
people
I'm telling you is that a lot of times, this is inconclusive.
I must admit that the goal yesterday that gave the Stoke equaliser for the handball by Routledge, I have seen every conceivable angle that would have been available to the officials, frame by frame, and there is absolutely nothing that suggests that he could remotely have handled that. It's either so bad a decision from Bobby Madeley that it's an extraordinary decision, or he's seen something that, from his position, is a lot clearer than every camera in the ground was able to pick up. And I have to think that it was the latter. You can have the video technology and you can look at it and you can go, well, do you know what? We've looked at this for 3 minutes and we're still not sure. So I think that there are incidents where it isn't cut and dry. The Ramirez one, on the other hand, I think is completely different.
Well, Mourinho doesn't think the Why are you laughing?
Because it's obvious. Come
on, you Chelsea boys have to stick together.
Gab, all I want is more consistency. And, of course, there's always going to be an extreme example of a penalty where, like Jim has just said, that we can't conclusively give an answer or the referee's totally good. But having that available, the game has to move forward. Right.
I will make a suggestion. I will throw this out there, and we'll start with Alison and tell me what you think of it, right? If you want an explanation, inclusion, referees file a report afterwards. How about at some point, whether it's Monday morning or in the evening, referees are made available to the media and they go and they explain, not justify, because, you know, we all appreciate it's difficult and so on. I mean, Michael Laudrup touched upon this, but they just explain their decisions after having watched it, maybe with the help of video, and they show what, you know, what their perspective was at the time, and they explain. And maybe if we did this, we would kind of realize that, you know, it can be a difficult job and some people make more mistakes than others.
I think that would undermine quite a large proportion of officials.
Why?
Because of what I said about going on TV or going public and saying it was, as the game was progressing and the speed at which the game was being played and the mood of the game, I felt in that context that it was a deliberate trip, for example.
Right.
And then the cameras will show, a replay might show that it wasn't.
That it wasn't,
and
then
I don't see where you go from there.
This guy made a mistake. Sir Alex Ferguson is widely considered to be the greatest ever British manager, right? If we put him on TV and he said, like, at the time, at the speed my mind was working at, I thought Bebe was going to be a phenomenal signing. And Cleberson, too. I mean, so what? You made a mistake. So what?
They don't talk like that. People don't talk like that, which is why referees are already...
Well, maybe referees should talk like that.
Get a lot of criticism. We'll get even more, because I think they will just end up looking stupid. It's very hard to say that you stand by a decision or explain why you did something when the cameras are telling the world that you just weren't on it. It wasn't correct. You cannot referee a match thinking at the back of your head, oh, my goodness, I'm going to have to go on television. You'd end up giving nothing at all because out of fear.
JP, I personally care more about the spectacle of football than I care about how referees feel. And actually, having had relationships with several referees, not relationships of those kind, Cass, what I found is that they don't like explaining themselves because their words get taken out of context and blah, blah, blah. But they like to explain themselves privately, and some of them are actually quite open to explaining how they made mistakes and why they made mistakes. Is it as much of a lose-lose proposition as Alison suggests?
I'd like to see it as well. Something I've talked about before, but the bottom line is what the referees say is that one of the principal reasons why it is never going to happen, certainly under the referee chiefs, will do everything they can to make sure it doesn't happen, because what they want to encourage are the people who are the best referees, not the people who can stand in front of a camera with a referee shirt on and represent referees the best. And there's a subtle difference, because they feel that if any referee is coming through as a fantastic referee but isn't a very good communicator necessarily with the media, might be a great communicator with the players on the pitch but would not be happy standing in front of a camera and wouldn't do himself justice standing in front of a camera, they don't want that person to be ruled out of being the best referee in the country. And that is, rightly or wrongly, that is one of the things that they hide behind to make sure that this will never happen. I would like to see it happen, though. I'm with you, Gab. I must admit, I think that, you know, back in sort of the old days, 20 years ago, I remember doing two or three games where there were decisions. One of the old referees, Eddie Ilderton, made a decision that seemed at the time to be very strange, and he fronted up in front of the cameras and he said, look, this is what I saw. You've seen replays. I didn't see a replay. This is what I saw. This is why I gave it. You can debate whether it's right or wrong, but I'm telling you that that was my train of thought and that is why the decision was made. And I think that if you can get to a stage where referees will do that, and even if there's no second question, yeah, but what if it's just a statement, this is what I saw and it was on this basis that I gave it, I would like to see that, but I don't think it will ever happen.
I don't see, Jim, how that's... It might be nice. You might think it's good telly or it's fun to watch a referee give their explanation. I don't see how it helps football for them to just look stupid every week.
No, it's not a question of entertainment or making it good television at all. I just think that the transparency. Sometimes you see a decision like the Routledge handball yesterday. It wasn't initially obvious what he'd given it for, whether it was for a push by Routledge, whether it was a handball, whether it was a handball by Leon Britton on the line. You just didn't know. And I think it's in that kind of situation that if a referee, I'm not asking for them to be strung up and made accountable and it to be the 21st century of being put in the equivalent of being put in the stocks and having tomatoes lobbed at them by the broadcasters. That's not what I'm asking for. I just sometimes as a fan, you look at a decision, you say, well, I don't understand what you've given. I don't understand where you're coming from with that. And it's just an explanation of the thought processes rather than being made to be a laughing stock.
All right, enough of that. Turning for some quick hits. Now, I was going to ask why Costel Pantelimon, all 6'8" of him, didn't come up for that set piece, but I realize that probably nobody cares. So instead, I will ask Alison about Liverpool. Brendan Rodgers, man, rolled to a 4-0 win over Fulham. Gerrard rolls back the years. I have to ask, Alison, please rank him in the pantheon of Liverpool greats. I'm assuming he's somewhere behind Kenny Dalglish, and because it's you, Stevie Highway as well, right?
Well, we seem to have a how great is Steven Gerrard question on the podcast almost every fortnight. So I think that in itself shows that he's a great player, and we just love repeating the fact he's a great player. More interesting, I think, is the fact is how much longer is he going to be a great player? He's 33. He played well against Fulham because Fulham were poor, and I don't really get why Brendan Rodgers isn't managing his time on the field better. He's a fantastic, fantastic, fantastic captain of the team. You don't have to play him every match, and there will come a time when he gets an injury because he's being overplayed, and Liverpool have got to learn how to play without him.
All right, so where does he rank?
Where does he rank?
Yes.
Well, I mean, in my opinion,
yes,
he ranks somewhere, oh, I don't know.
Top five?
Top five.
But not top three?
Maybe top three.
Really tough day for Fulham, many calling for Martignol's head. JP, if you were in charge, would you sack him? And will the club sack him?
I think the club will sack him. And it's the home form that is going to be the problem for him. And I think that I would imagine that Monday, the 25th of November, might be the day that he goes. Because I think that if Fulham extend their poor run at home to 1-10 at Craven Cottage, that will be enough. And he'll be out after the next home game. I don't think you can sack him necessarily on the back of a 4-0 defeat at Liverpool. You've got to look at Liverpool's last home game was a 4-1 win against West Brom, where that flattered West Brom something chronic, and then a fortnight later they go and should have won at Chelsea. So I don't necessarily think that you can take one performance in isolation, albeit a really poor one away from home. But Shad Khan will be running out of patience. He has shown in his short time at Jacksonville that he's more than happy to hire and fire when results don't go their way. He's been in there less than 2 years. He's already got rid of one underperforming coach with another under fire and made sure that another was disposed of just before he took over. So clearly he's a man who's quite happy to make a change at the top. I think that the transfer policy at Fulham has not been great. They've left themselves with too many of the same type of players. It's too old, the average age of the squad, and I think Yol's days, unfortunately, are numbered.
Let's move on to West Brom. They get a point at Stamford Bridge, and it could have easily been three without an Andre Mariner decision we discussed earlier. But Cascarino, on your inquest today, you suggest that Peter Cech could maybe even should be facing the axe?
It's on the brink. Some of his goalkeeping decisions and errors.
But they're not going to bring in Courtois in January.
Well,
so
Mourinho.
What are you going to do, play the old guy?
Casillas in Real Madrid, as you know, got dropped for very few mistakes, but he did make some. The goal at Everton, I thought he was flat-footed. He could totally have just moved his feet a bit quicker, got off the line and took the goal that Naismith got. Then I saw, obviously, the goal that Aguero got for Man City, and it was a great strike. I think that's a goalkeeper's bread and butter, the way, just near his hand, I think he can tip it over. Then obviously the second goal at the weekend against West Brom, a really poor goalkeeping error. And I really feel that Petr Cech is going to be one of the ones that could be made a scapegoat for Chelsea's failings in games like the weekend.
One of the weird things at Chelsea, and obviously they do have a pretty reliable backup in Schwarzer, and the nice thing about Schwarzer is that, you know, if you did make the change, Schwarzer could see you through the end of the season, but you wouldn't have to worry about signing up long-term because he's so old, and then you could bring in Courtois or whatever. The amazing thing, though, is that...
Already.
Stop it. Petr Cech is so tight with Christoph Lolichon, the Chelsea goalkeeping coach, that it would majorly blow up if they were to make that change. Palace and Everton draw. Good point for Mr. Millen, but they'll have a new boss after the break. Alison, who do you think it will be, and who should it be?
Well, the only name at the moment left in the pot is Karanka, and everyone's been going, oh my goodness, but he's never managed. How would he cope? I'm not a Palace fan, so I mean, if as a Palace fan, I'd be worried. But as a sort of neutral observer, I think it would be great fun indeed if the Spaniard came over.
Why would it be fun? And he's Basque.
He
likes to be referred to as Basque, not Spanish. But why would it be fun to have Aitor Karanka?
Why would it be fun?
Yeah, Mourinho's lackey. Why?
Simply because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you've got a club in Palace's... I mean, and also the owners of Palace have said initially it was very important to have someone with a connection to the club, who understood the club and how important it was for the club to survive. And to go from that standpoint to flying in Karanka for an interview seems slightly bizarre, and it doesn't make sense. But then, you know, at Southampton, people were going, who the heck is Pochettino, and why? What does he know about football in the Premier League and on the South Coast, and what do we mean? So... It's interesting.
All right. Foolish people were saying, who the hell is Pochettino? And Mr. Cortez's wisdom was once again revealed to be correct. But speaking of Southampton, Adam Lallana turned in a masterclass, and Saints are now third in the table. Now, apart from the usual familiar praise for Mr. Cortez, or Dr. Cortez, as I like to call him, who proved that he is far more clever than Alan Pardew and Nigel Atkins, and all the mugs and servants who criticized him before, JP, should... Cortese be planning to have his Tuesdays and Wednesdays busy next season with the Champions League?
It's too early for that yet, but you can't take anything away from what they've achieved. But when it comes down to it, they are third. This time last year, West Brom were third and finished in the bottom half, or finished just inside the top half. I think if Southampton will finish seventh or eighth this year, then that's a great achievement. If you look at the number of points that have been picked up over the last 12 months... Southampton, I think, would be eighth. They might be seventh after the weekend, but they would be seventh or eighth. That's where I expect them to finish at the end of the season. They don't have quite enough depth in the squad if they have significant injuries, but seventh or eighth is a wonderful achievement.
Second win over a London club in 2 weeks for Newcastle as Tim Krul saves everything in sight. Cass, you get two goalkeeping questions this week. Are you lucky? Was it just a case of Spurs dominating and being unlucky, as AVB seemed to suggest?
There's a lot of frustration in there. Were they unlucky? I wouldn't go that far. I thought, Tim Krul had a really good game and pulled off some fine saves in the game. A lot of them quite comfortable for a top keeper. I thought there was a lot of disappointment things as well, though, for AVB. I thought Paulinho, I thought Soldado.
Townsend,
disappointing. They looked like they lacked a bit of belief. That was a strange thing. Eriksen, confidence. You know, for a team that's been flying so high, that was a real disappointing aspect of their game. Did he win them the match, Tim Krul? He played a big part, but I thought Newcastle was a team, you know, they really were spot on and denied Tottenham a lot of space in areas. And, hey, like Remy, keeps doing what you're doing.
There you go, the magic of Alan Pardew.
Got one for you now, Gab. We're talking about Dortmund losing, Bayern Munich setting new records, but I'd rather hear about the two Champions League finals that took place this weekend.
That's right. There's a Champions League beyond the UEFA Champions League. In fact, there were two of them this weekend, and I think that they're both really, really good tales. In Africa, Al Ahly of Egypt and my mate Mohamed Abu Trika, we discussed last week, and so that means that they qualify for the Club World Cup. It is special, and please watch the Club World Cup. It might be your last chance to see Mohamed Abu Trika play. And the other one was in Asia, the Asian Champions League, Guangzhou Evergrande beating FC Seoul. Guangzhou Evergrande, coached by a certain Marcello Lippi, who becomes the first manager in history to win the Champions League in two different continents. And, of course, he's also won a small thing we call the World Cup, and he says that apart from winning the World Cup, this equals any other footballing success he's ever had. All right, thanks to my panel, Tony Cascarino, Jim Proudfoot, and of course, Allison Rudd. Please check out details of our live shows, specifically the one coming up in Newcastle on the 20th of November. You can use the links on our SoundCloud page as well. And you can write to us, gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. So many of you do just that every single week, and it's a pleasure to hear from you. Till next time, thank you for listening.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.